The following live presentation by Rabbi David Aaron is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
This is going to be a series. This is a series called Habits of Highly Spiritual People. And the text that we're going to be using right now, anyways, is a text from Rav Kook. Rabbi Abraham Isaac Kook, of all Jewish thinkers, I think has had the most impact on my orientation, my understanding of Judaism. He lived between the years 1865 to 1935. And what's somewhat metaphorically fascinating about that is 35 years of his life was in the 19th century, and 35 years of his life was in the 20th century. So, and when you get into his writings, you realize, you appreciate how he really is a bridge, you know, between these two centuries. And what's so powerful in his writings, although he's very difficult to understand, is that here is a rabbi who is asking the questions that 20th century people ask. You know, not, or you could pick up a lot of fantastic books, but they're not contemporary enough for us to, or for them to be asking the questions that we're asking in our generation. So here's a rabbi who's obviously read, I don't know how much, but definitely he's read the writings of Friedrich Nietzsche. He's read the writings of Hegel. He's read the writings of Immanuel Kant. So in the late 1900s, the late 19th century, the late 1800s, you begin to see a phenomena called atheism, whereby it was no longer just individuals, but it became the almost the cultural norm of people. So Rav Kook is able to respond to issues and challenges that we are very much the children of in the 20th century. And that's why I find his writing so helpful. And if people feel that Israelite is in some ways especially relevant, I can only attribute to the influence that I am under from the teachings of Rav Kook. Rav Kook was a Kabbalist, and much of Kabbalistically what I feel I've been blessed to understand really was from his writings. He takes the writings of the Arizal, Rav Isaac Laurier, who is perhaps the leading figure in Jewish history for the teachings of Kabbalah, or at least the translation of the Kabbalah, and Rav Kook cracks open some of the deepest secrets. In fact, he even mentioned at the end of his life that he's afraid that he was dying young. He didn't die so young, but he didn't die very, very old in his life, because perhaps he had revealed secrets that maybe the world or he wasn't really right or ready to reveal. So he went out on a limb for the Jewish people, because he believed, and he said this, that we're in a generation that unless we open up the brightest lights of the secrets of Judaism, we will lose our people. Right? And that is what's influenced me and Israelites thinking. Rav Kook explains that, and this he's saying in the early 1900s. He said, we are going to witness such a downfall of Jewish identity that the only response to reawaken or re-excite Jews to their heritage is to open up the brightest lights, the secrets of Judaism. Right? And he says, and the downfall of the Jewish people, which will necessitate this kind of response, was really the ascent of the Jewish people. We were falling upwards. Because his attitude was that the people were evolving spiritually, intellectually and spiritually, and unless Jewish education addresses their needs, you're going to lose them. Because they're going to feel that Judaism isn't speaking to them, because Judaism doesn't have the depth that they are seeking or experiencing in other traditions or in other teachings or other you know, or within literature. And therefore his belief is, and this very much has influenced my belief in the direction of Israelite as an organization, is we believe that the challenge of Jewish education today is that it's not the Jews, it's the teaching or it's the approach to Judaism. In other words, I've heard educators that think the reason why we have, you know, in America today, over 60% intermarriage, and in some areas of the country, it's up to like 95%, or some areas of outside the country. For instance, France is about 90% intermarriage, right? And so there are those who will say that that's because there's something wrong with the people. We're in a society that's decadent. We're in a society that's filled with so much allurement, seduction, secularism, materialism, right? Rav Kook would have said, and would say to that, no, it's because the Jewish education is not rising to the challenge of the maturity, the spiritual maturity of the Jewish people, right? We've got the goods, but our teachers are not delivering it to the people. And personally, that's what I see, that's what I believe. That if you go into ashrams or you go into some of these New Age retreats and you look at the lists of the educators or the lists of the facilitators, you will find that an incredible high percentage of those people are Jewish. Right? And that's really quite remarkable. I met a couple of weeks ago, actually, with a woman named Marianne Williamson. I don't know if you're familiar with Marianne Williamson. And she and I at one point shared the same publicist, so I called up our mutual publicist, Ariel, who's also Jewish, and I asked if she could set up a meeting, tell Marianne I'd like to meet her. So Marianne was in New York, same time I was in New York, so we went out to dinner together Friday night, Motzi Shabbos. And we had an amazing discussion. You know, I mean, so much of what we would say to each other was the same, you know, but I was coming from the background of Torah. She doesn't have much of a background in Torah. She has a background in the Course of Miracles. And she was just like saying, really? Yeah, I believe that. And she's just never heard this from a rabbi. And that's what's sad, is you have very highly sophisticated spiritual Jews today who do not believe that Judaism is highly sophisticated and spiritual. And I was gratified when someone who works with a very large outreach organization said the difference between Israelite and perhaps the other Jewish educational centers or organizations is you believe that you can teach advanced ideas to people who have little background. I said, you're right. That's exactly what I believe. Right? He wasn't criticizing. He was just, you know, remarking that he sees that Israelite has this attitude that you can teach advanced ideas to people who have little backgrounds. And that's exactly what Rav Kook believed, and that was the influence to how I was inspired to somehow direct the organization, which is, this is the problem. The problem is that Jews demand more and deserve more because we are highly spiritual people. Whether we like it or not, pain has a way of making you very spiritual, right? And as a people suffering what we've suffered, the challenges that we've had in history, you can't not be spiritual, right? You just can't not ask those big questions in life. So this is habits of highly spiritual people. And this particular piece that I'm going to share with you today is from a book called Midot, which means character traits or could be habits. And the book is actually in alphabetical order, which itself is a strange thing. He doesn't seem to put it in order of what he thinks are priorities. He just puts it in alphabetical order. My guess on that is that it's because these kind of spiritual habits, it's not like first, second, third. It's kind of like watching a photograph developing in developer. It doesn't develop vertically or horizontally, right? It, you know, a little bit here and a little bit there because it's holistic. Truth is whole, right? And where do you break into truth? Where do you start with truth? to a certain way doesn't quite matter, because you have to go through the circle and see the whole picture. And then once you've seen the whole picture, you got to go over it a number of times to see the whole picture. So perhaps that's why it's in alphabetical order, because he really didn't believe that there is an order, right? That I can't say, well, first you do this and then you do that. Okay, but I decided for our sake that I would take a certain order of what I thought would be more fundamental to build towards. So what I want to do is spend a little time exploring the meaning of faith, right? Because to me, everything is based on this, right? What you believe is essentially what in your life you will receive, right? And so I want to try and understand, what does it mean to be a person of faith, right? And we've all heard the comment, blind faith, or you're just going on faith. A person who would describe themselves as a person of faith, I think now it's a little less problematic, but certainly around 10 years ago, that would be considered to be like, you're not sophisticated, right? Or I had a student, and this is going back to about 14 years ago in Israelite. She was a professor of philosophy in a college in California. She had told me that if her colleagues were to know that she believes in God, her whole credibility as an academic, right, would be shot. So she cannot reveal to people, she was telling me this in confidence, that she can't let people know that she actually believes in God, because that would totally destroy her credibility, right, as a teacher of philosophy, right? Now, I don't know if that's true today, 14 years later. You know, 14 years later, people believing in angels, people scanning Zohars, that's like acceptable, right? That people believe in things that don't have scientific basis at all, right? But once upon a time, if you can't prove it, it doesn't exist, and you're just going by faith, and that's not good enough, okay? So what I want to try and do is understand, well, what is faith? And how does one achieve faith? Or actually, what we will soon see is actually faith isn't something that you achieve. Right? It is a completely different paradigm of how one becomes a master of faith. Okay? So I'm going to pass out to you... how do we do this? Why do you think your kids are like that? Because unfortunately we do see in our community, even in the Old City, where kids are leaving Judaism. And children of Balei Tshuva, these are children of parents who've kind of like had this renewal of interest in Judaism, you know, and now suddenly they're seeing their children embrace a secular lifestyle that they ran away from, right? That they were so sure, the parents were so sure, was so poisonous, and now it breaks their heart to see their children going in that direction. Now, I'm not saying there's millions of kids in the Old City going in that direction. They're certainly not, right? But unfortunately, it is a phenomena of children leaving Judaism. Children meaning teenagers leaving Judaism. And there is a phenomena, I can't give you statistics, but I've seen with my eyes, of children of Balei Tshuva, of people who've returned to Judaism, leaving Judaism. So you imagine how devastating that would be, right? That you just know what life was and could have been and wasn't, and what you've worked so hard to achieve in your life and reorient yourself to a life of value, a life of sacredness and sanctity, and your kids, you know, bringing home these albums that you burnt, you know, this music that you ran away from or just like dumped. So how can it be? So people have asked us, you know, we interrupt, hopefully it keeps going that way. It's like, well, so what do you do to keep a child really excited about being Jewish? And our attitude was, if it's a positive association, then it'll be a positive thing in their life. I mean, I've not heard, you know, once, but a good few times students telling me that, yeah, my father came from a religious home, but I remember him telling me how his father hit him because he accidentally turned the light on at Shabbat, right? Or he went to Hebrew school and the Rebbe, you know, would slap him or hit him with a ruler over his hand if he wasn't concentrating in his Mishnayot. Right? So, and I've heard such stories. You say, whoa, what happened to us? How could that be? If a child has a real positive, experientially positive experience with being Jewish, they're going to want to be Jewish. I remember Liadia, who now, you know, is a mother, mind-boggling. She was like 14 or 15 years old. We went up north for a vacation in a yeshuv, and we took a walk outside the yeshuv, and someone drove by in their car, right, on Shabbat. And I remember the pained look on Liadia's face. She said, Abba, how could someone drive on Shabbat? She wasn't angry. She wasn't being critical. She was just in shock. It was like, I can't get it. I'm like, how would you not want to celebrate Shabbat? Why would you even think of getting in a car on Shabbat if you knew what you were missing or what you were giving up by not celebrating Shabbat? And I was like, whoa. I mean, it was just such a deep, guttural, you know, visceral feeling that she had about Shabbat. And it's because the child, when they grow up, it's got to be sensual. It's not about intellectually explaining to the child anything, although that's there too. But it's about them tasting the sweetness of life, right? And they just get it in such a natural way. And then, you know, once they get to the level of comprehension, so now you start getting into stories, right? It's not just about, you know, singing Jewish songs and dances or colors or clay, you know, the sensual contact with Jewish life. But now you begin to teach them stories, and they get it, they understand it. I remember my son Nuriel, at night I would ask my children to tell me a story. And he said to me, Abba, I've had a great story. I don't know how old he was, maybe 9 or, no, it must have been less, maybe 7 or 8 years old. He said, there were these pirates, and I don't know what a pirate was. Pirates, yes, and there were these pirates that attacked the ship on sea. Yeah. And I think, pirates, like, you know, like parrots? There are a bunch of birds attacked. You know, pirates, oh, but don't you know what pirates are? And it was pirates, okay? But it was a Hebrewized pirates. Okay, so finally figure out it's pirates. And the pirates attacked the ship. And they went on board, and they took away from everyone, everything they had. But Abba, there was one person on the ship that what he had, they couldn't take away from him. So imagine me, I'm lying there with my thumb in my mouth. Yeah, what is it? Right? Right? And he said, Abba, you don't know what it is? I said, no, what is it? Well, what could you not take away from someone? He said, Abba, Torah, Judaism. That you can't take away from someone. Could you imagine? I don't know what you were thinking about when you were 7 years old, but to me, Popeye the Sailor Man was what went through my mind. You know, Bugs Bunny went through my mind. I had no sense of, you know, a sense of values in one's life, a belief system that one is committed to. And even a little boy saying, you can't take Torah away from somebody. You know, so that's at a level of comprehension, but also a sense of the sweetness of it, the positive feeling of being Jewish, just on a purely experiential way. But now there's comprehension. But now we get to, what? How do you teach faith? How do you teach? When do you start teaching your child to believe, right, in a higher power? And so Rav Kook explains, of course, based on Jewish sources, an education as a conditioning in faith begins from the moment of the child's conception. When will you teach a child faith? It's the moment of conception. What does that mean? I didn't say anything to the kid. I didn't even know what kid was going to happen, right? And some kids, maybe a high portion of kids today are accidents. You know, we weren't really intending to have another one, but what are you going to know? Who knows, right? What does that mean? That's a total paradigm shift. Obviously, faith isn't what we think, because faith is something you teach people. Not only that, faith is something you indoctrinate people. Right? That's what most people would think faith is all about. You just drill into your kid that they believe. I once saw a movie on neo-Nazism. Whoa. Did that freak me out? They spoke to a little boy, and they asked him what he would do if he saw a Jew. And I couldn't believe what poured out of the hatred that poured out of this little boy. Right? Now, did it come from thinking? Did it come from personally meeting Jews? Having a long, deep understanding of the history of Judaism? The history? No! It's just his parents just filled this kid. Right? Just brainwashed this kid with this is what it's about. You know? Sadly, I've been told, I've heard this numerous times, that there are places in, you know, amongst the Palestinians where they learn math. Through, if you have 10 Jews and you kill 8 Jews, how many Jews will you have? Right? So, like, isn't this a belief system? Doesn't belief start with ideas that one is inculcated with? No, not emunah. That's something else. That might be just simply warped educating, brainwashing. Emunah isn't something you infuse a person with through cognitive communication. It's not information. Emunah, when the Rambam talks about the 13 principles of faith, if you adhere to those 13 principles, if you say, yes, I buy into those 13 principles, that does not mean you are a person of faith. Because faith is not a collection of ideas. Faith is a state of being. Right? It's a state of being. This is a whole different thing. So when a person is saying, well, how do I get to faith? You got to know what it is to get to it. Right? Because what is it? Rav Kook in another place explains that faith is the revelation of the self, of yourself. It is the basic self-revealing of your inner essence. Right? It's not something that you achieve. It's not something that you accomplish in the sense of adding more information, amassing more knowledge. Right? It's actually something that you need to release from yourself in essence. A friend of mine was writing a book on holy women. You know, there's a lot of books on holy men, famous holy rabbis. She decided that she was going to write a book interviewing holy rebbetzins, holy spiritual women leaders. So she met with this one woman who was known for giving blessings for fertility. Right? Many women go to this particular woman to be blessed for fertility. And this woman is a survivor of Auschwitz, and she herself was subject to medical experimentation. So, in the name of medicine, they made this woman infertile in the concentration camp. And this woman is sterile. She's not able to have children. And she is known to have some amazing channeling ability to channel blessings for children to women. Okay, so my friend went to meet with her, as amongst the other many amazing women that she interviewed. But my friend said that when she interviewed this woman, it was such a paradigm shift in what a holy person really is. What a person of emunah, of let's for now say faith, really is. She says, because until now I used to think that the way one comes to spirituality, a real heightened sense of commitment to sanctity, is something that you build, like a building. You know, you put another floor and another floor and another floor. But when I met this woman, I realized that the person of emunah is not one that is built up to, but is stripped down to essence. This woman was just pure essence. Right? And so rather the image of kind of building and amassing is kind of stripping, peeling away the layers and getting to that essence of who you are. And what we'll discover is the path to God is yourself. That when a person reaches the deepest level of awareness of who they are, who they really are, which will be the most mystifying, most overwhelming, you will be left absolutely speechless when you get to that point where you just so experience the existential suchness where you can say, I am. Before you say, I am David Aaron, before you say, I am a teacher, before you say, I am a Canadian, you just get to that point of the I am-ness. That is just totally the link to the divine. So she said when she spoke to this woman, she was just totally overwhelmed by her simplicity. Now actually, that's not the word. There's a difference between being simple and simplistic. She wasn't simplistic. She was simple. She was just simply herself. Now, I don't meet that many people today that I feel hasn't somehow been adulterated. The most simple self I saw yesterday, 4 a.m. Like, just nothing but me, as is, into the world. It's just like getting back to that simple. And in fact, that's what they say really was the sin of Adam and Eve. The Midrash says that Hashem created us straight, right? And we sought complexities. We're in a world where people feel that the more complex they can be and sound, the more sophisticated they are, right? Whereby complexity is not what we're seeking. We're looking for just the simple you. And how does one get to the simple you? Where does it start? So Rav Kook says, at conception. You give over to the child at conception because faith is part and parcel of just who you are, right? And who you are is determined at the moment of conception. I mean, obviously you evolve, but essence happens at that moment. And therefore, this is a whole new thinking about, well, what is faith? How does one achieve faith? Do I go to a class that gives me the 10 proofs of God? That'll just give you ideas about faith, right? That might tell you intellectually that maybe people of faith aren't intellectually ridiculous, right? Like there's a book called Permission to Believe, which is a very clever and appropriate title, because essentially it's not that what I'm going to share with you as evidence for the existence of God is proof, but rather it's permission to believe intellectually what you know is true in the most visceral, direct, self-evident way. But you know, we are intellectual beings and we do deserve and we do need to give intellectual, to substantiate intellectually what we know directly. But don't confuse the knowing directly with your intellectualism, which I did for many, many years in my life, right? Which I just thought, the more you talk it out, the more you think about it, the more you get there, right? And my whole reevaluation in the last maybe 10 years is trying to get to that direct experience of who I am, what this is, why we are. Which at that point you can't really say to any, you can't write books on that. Because your book will basically say, I've got nothing to say. Right? If you want to find truth, then I have nothing to say. Right? That's why at a certain point, It becomes more and more difficult to talk about what you know, because at that place of knowing, you know there are no words that could anyway do justice to what you know at that moment. That is the beginning of the opening to, so where does one go for faith? Right. So at one time in my life, I was working with an organization that really believed that the way to inspire Jews back to Judaism is to prove to them the existence of God. And I always was resistant to that approach. And people there knew that I was resistant to the approach. I was respectful. It just wasn't an approach that I personally felt comfortable with and personally didn't think was so effective. So there was this fellow who showed up to the yeshiva. He actually was kind of pulled off from the wall and brought over to the yeshiva. And the guys start working on him. And they're having the toughest time with this guy. His name was Nathan. Toughest time, you know. I don't believe in God. So, he doesn't believe in God. So they start hamming away with proof number one and proof number two. And they're hamming away this guy, getting all these real intense philosophical discussion with this guy. And nothing's moving this guy. Continues to say, there's no such thing. There's no God. I don't believe in God. Right? So, totally frustrated, they turned to me. They said, okay, you try. You're lucky with this guy. We can't get anywhere with this guy. So, I was in my early 20s at the time, and I took this guy, Nathan, for a walk. And I said, Nathan, let me ask you something. I mean, what is it that you're finding difficult with these proofs? Because, I mean, not that that's my way, but you have to admit there is substance to it. I mean, there's some real solid, rational content to what they're presenting. And he says, I don't believe in God. There's no such thing as a God. Right? I said, but tell me, what is it that you're bothered by? What is missing, rationally at least, in their arguments? I don't believe in God. I don't believe in God. So I said, but what is it, Nathan? So he looks at me and says, don't you get it? Don't you get it? If there really is a God, look at that bird. Look at that butterfly. Look at that ant. Look at that person. No, I can't. No, there is no God. And he ran away from me. Right? It was so interesting. This guy had problems with God because he had the most intense belief in God. Because if there really is a God, and we really are creations of a creator, and you really got that, I mean, you'd just be blown away every second. How could you take, it would be sensory overload constantly, right? To protect himself, he decided to be an atheist. He just couldn't handle experientially what he knew when he looked at the world. It so blew him away. They just couldn't believe in God, and certainly couldn't believe in the very small thinking of some being with a beard flowing out. And so he didn't want to talk to me. I went back to the yeshiva, and the guys were waiting, rooting. Did you get him? Did you get him? And he says, did you convince him that there's a God? I said, I don't know what I did for him, but he definitely convinced me there is a God. Because when he just said, look at that bird, I suddenly looked at the bird. I go, who looks at birds? In that immediate, direct, non-comprehensing, not trying to categorize, just look at it. And it was just, whoa. Faith is not something you build up to. What Rav Kook is going to reveal is all the talk that we do is only to access faith. It's only to expose the inner knowing, the direct self-evident truth that we know through ourselves, as ourselves. In that most immediate taste of the mystery and the wonder of just being able to say, I am. And at that point, when you truly, truly get to that deep experience of fully, honestly, saying and feeling and experience and knowing the mystery of I am, you won't be able to say I am an accident. If you can put those two together and say I am an accident, you haven't yet come to know the meaning of the experience of the truth of I am-ness. So that's the beginning of this, which is faith starts with conception. Before you even came to the world, it is part of who you are. It really is who you are. You achieve emunah by achieving simply being you, but experiencing simply being you. And when you and there's not too many people are doing that anymore, because I'm constantly trying to simply be what you want me to be, or simply be what everyone's telling me I could be or should be. I remember years ago I saw, you know, when all the rage was dressing up like Madonna, which is actually dressing down like Madonna. So I remember a woman, a journalist went up to this girl and said, well, why do you dress that way? So she had gum in her mouth. She said, to express my individuality. That's how you express your individuality, look like her. So how does one really get past the conform? Which is so interesting, because most people would think, well, isn't that what Judaism is about? It's just conforming, right? But really, in the deepest depths of Judaism, right, the goal is to come back to the simple you, to that straight you, to strip down from the complexities, right? And at that moment, where you just touch essence in its most basic sense, as it happened in that very first moment of coming to be, that is the beginning, he says, the beginning of educating oneself and others to faith. So in terms of our children, God bless us, you know, you have to realize that he give it to your children in conception, right? And the Talmud talks about the state of mind people in when they're having relations, right? That you're really determining the nature of the soul of this child. Right? And that's just the beginning. But faith isn't something you acquire. Faith isn't something you simply study. Right? Faith is not a collection of principles. Right? All that plays a role. But the essence of faith is really the essence of simply being you. That experience of, and the mystery of, and the miracle of, I am-ness. Let's hear some questions. Right. Right. You know, there was a book written, I can't remember by who, but and I never read it, but I was fascinated by the title, called Does God Belong in My Bedroom? Right. Does God belong in my bedroom? Jewish tradition believes that there are three partners in the creation of a human being. There is the mother and the father, and of course, God. And to the extent that one invites God as a partner will determine how godly the child is, which will infuse, you would say, the power of faith in the child, because as we're beginning to hint to, that faith is a deep sense of the divine within me, expressed through me, but not me, right? And that's, but just, not just saying that, that's easy for me to say. I'm talking about knowing that, experiencing that in a very deep, personal way. And so, does God belong in my bedroom? Well, it depends what you're hoping to accomplish in your bedroom. Right. And Rav Kook says in other places in Judaism, you know, it clarifies this, that really sexuality without God becomes boring and destructive, because what really unites and turns this physical act into a spiritual act, right? Unless it's somehow connected to a higher power, a sense of an experience beyond ourselves, beyond for the sake of ourselves, right? And at that point you are determining, right, what you perceive and what you conceive at that moment. Yeah. What? I didn't finish that thought. I just began it. It's part of all of this. You see, See, to me, this is the struggle, and this is part of my struggle, in formulating Israelite with the dream, and God willing, we're seeing it starting to come true, of truly educating people. Is the goal to see a lot of kippahs on people's heads, right? To see a lot of women lighting Shabbos candles, is that the goal? No, that would maybe be symptomatic of the goal. But don't confuse the symptoms with the goal. Because just having a bunch of people dress the part isn't going to guarantee the next generation of Jews, right? And I've had people come into my office and say, you know, Rabbi, I want to put on a kippah. I tell the guy, well, are you sure you want to do that? Now, they're a little surprised because they would think that I'd be jumping for joy with, you know, anxiously hoping, when can I nail another beanie on another Jew's head, right? And I'm a little worried about it, because if a person puts that on, then I'm hoping that it'll stay on. And if they put it on before they're ready for it, then I might be running the risk that they'll take it off and never come back to it. Right? Because it's too much, too fast, they weren't integrated, they didn't understand why and what they were doing, and they were doing it to either please me or to feel part of this community, which isn't a bad thing to do. I mean, we all want to feel part of the community, and that's very natural. But you got to be very, very careful. So, I recommend, if in terms of a man, that if you want to start somewhere, then I would suggest maybe you want to put on tzitzit, but don't wear your tzitzit out. Because it's not for anybody to see, it's not for you to make a statement to the world, right, and tie yourself in, but maybe it's just something you want to feel and experience, how you feel about it when you do that, right? So you don't feel some kind of social pressure if you take it off. I have a friend who actually is a convert to Judaism, but very, very quickly he put on a black hat and a black coat. I'm not saying that's bad or good in terms of dress. Obviously, you see that I don't dress that way. But I'm not saying that's bad or good. But he told me later on, and you have to say he put it on within about 2-3 weeks of, you know, his conversion. He said that was one of the biggest mistakes in my journey to Judaism, because suddenly I wasn't able to ask beginner questions. I felt embarrassed. Because I would ask something and people would look at me like, well, you're so frum, you're so religiously evolved, you're asking that question? That's the end of education, if you ever feel embarrassed to ask a question, right? I mean, to me, I pray that I always ask beginner questions, right? And I think maybe that's why I've been able to write books that have been able to reach a lot of different levels of people. Because I'm always asking beginner questions. It's a little annoying for myself and probably my wife too. But I'm always asking. You don't just assume. I don't mind going back to the ABC once again. Because to me that's the most profound. Right? But once a person gets to a point where they can't ask, I'm too evolved to ask that question. How will I look? So our concern of Vinny and myself and the Educated Israelite, we want to see a healthy revival of Jewish tradition in the world. It's not enough. It won't get us to the next generation if we're able to sell more yarmulkes, right? And sell more candlesticks, right? And get more people to say blessings like this, blah, 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 right? That's not going to get us to the times of Mashiach fast enough, right? It's about really not being a technician, but a real musician. So that's the question over here, which I struggled with, because I'm a Baal Tshuva, you know. And when I first came in, I was wearing a knitted kippah with white roses and my name Dave on it, you know. And I was wearing these torn blue jeans that took me years to develop, you know. I mean, like, really, you know, with these leather patches, I was very proud. It was who I was. I was very, very proud of myself. And then the Rosh Yeshiva of the first yeshiva I went to, thank God I was doing very well, and they decided to put me in the top class in the yeshiva only after about 3 months of studying. Right? So Baruch Hashem, and it wasn't because of my intelligence, there was a guy in the yeshiva who took me on like his personal mission and kept me up every night till 2-3 in the morning teaching me, and I just advanced incredibly quickly because this guy took such a personal interest in me, and the yeshiva decided to put me into the top Gemara class after only about 3 or 4 months of learning in yeshiva at all. Right? But when they admitted me in there, the Rosh Yeshiva took me aside and he did something so educational I couldn't stand it. Right? Because he said to me, David, we're going to be putting you in the top class in the yeshiva, and I know that you're going to be going for your summer vacation, right? And you're going to be going back, your friends are going to look at you and they're going to wonder what's changed. And I'm just asking you to think, is that the way you want to dress? Now, I was so angry at him, because if he would have said to me, those stinking blue jeans, take them off, I could say, oh yeah, right? No. But he did something that so upset me. He empowered me to have to think responsibly and make my own choice, and let me know that he'd respect my choice. Now what am I supposed to do? Right? I can't rebel. Right? No, I really, it was brilliant. He asked me so sweetly, I ask you to consider, is that the way you want to dress? He also said, listen, I know that dress is external, but still externalities do communicate things to the outside world. Just think about it. Ugh. Just think about it. Now I have to think about it. Now it's in my laps. What an educator, you know, annoyed me. And you know what? It was really hard for me to do. It was a major breakthrough in my life that I decided not to wear blue jeans at that point. Right? And certainly not blue jeans that looked like that. And it was like, wow, that was hard for me. And my journey to Judaism has been a struggle with this, because so I was in Zionist yeshivas and I was totally comfortable with the knitted kippah and the Dave on it and the white roses, but then I ended up in what they call a black hat yeshiva, but I didn't care, I still wore the Dave with the roses, right? I wasn't wearing blue jeans anymore. And then, you know, I started getting comments about, you know, black kippahs rather than knitted colorful ones. And then I was like feeling uncomfortable and feeling not part of the community. And again, I had to decide, well, should I change my kippah? So I changed my kippah. Now I'm wearing a nice black velvet kippah, but I'm not going to wear a black hat. No way. And then I went to another yeshiva, which was even considered more in that ilk of Jewish identity. And I was the only guy there not wearing a black hat. And one of the heads of the yeshiva took me over and did a very non-educational thing. It was right before Rosh Hashanah. And he said to me, David, it's time to do tshuva. It's time to repent. I said, oh, I know, I know, I know. And after saying, this man never spoke to me. It was the first time he ever spoke to me. He calls me over, David, you've got to do tshuva. I said, oh, yeah, I want to. And I thought he had some deep insight to my personality, something he saw me do wrong. He says, David, are you really ready to come back to God and do tshuva? I said, yes, Rabbi, sure, of course, of course. He says, so David, buy a black hat. I was so crushed. That's what it is. And again, I'm not against black hats, don't get me wrong, but I'm certainly against it the way he presented it to me. Right? And so I was so angry at the way he presented it and the judgmental feeling about it. That's right. So I went out and I bought a black hat with Mickey Mouse ears. No, but that was what my first comment was, yes, you'll see me with a black hat. But then I had that moment of maturity, those painful moments, you know, those painful moments where you say, what's this really about, David? And so I thought about it. And I said, listen, to me, these externalities don't really mean anything. And then my other voice says, so if they don't, why don't you buy one? Right? And that was like, oh, shut up. Right? Because if they really don't mean anything, and you really believe it doesn't mean anything, so it doesn't mean anything to wear it, and it doesn't mean anything not to wear it. So if he would like you to wear it, and everybody else is wearing it, so maybe you should wear it. So I went out and bought the cheapest black hat I could find, because I didn't think I'd wear it too long. And I walked in wearing a black hat, and I started wearing a black coat, and I did that for about 2 years. Right? 2 years. I went to sleep with it. I showered with it. I was from. And really what happened was, after 2 years, it just didn't feel that that's what I have to do halakhically. Right? And I remember my roommate, I had a discussion with him. Well, do we have to wear a black hat or don't we have to wear a black hat? And he went to one of the greatest sages in Jerusalem, right? And he asked him whether he has to wear a black hat. And the rabbi said no. But his friend went the day before, right? And he went to him and said, do I have to wear a black hat? And the rabbi said yes. So the guy said to him, he told me I don't have to. So the other fellow said, it doesn't make any sense. So he went back to his Rabbi Eliyashiv, if I recall the story correctly. He went back to the rabbi. He said, Rabbi, I went to you and you said, do I have to wear a black hat? And you said, yes. My friend came the next day and he says, do you have to wear a black hat? And you said, no. So why? He says, well, because your friend came to me not wearing a black hat, and you came to me wearing a black hat. So if you think as a sign of reverence in my presence you should wear a black hat, all the more so in the presence of God, but for your friend the black hat was not a symbol of reverence, and therefore he didn't need to wear a black hat. That was an interesting understanding of how Jewish law could play out. So in terms of conformity, I'm not saying there isn't something to conformity, but there is a balance between how does this become a genuine expression of myself as a soul, and a genuine expression of myself as a soul as a member of the Jewish people. That's a genuine expression of myself as a soul. And yet, when do I start losing touch with the essence and the real point of all this? You know, and that's what's really scary, when people start losing a point, you know, and then what happens? So, and that's easy, because when you take a lifestyle, then you start to sometimes convince yourself that I don't have to put the work in, right? That now that I'm saying blessings perhaps before I eat, I got it, you know, I got it down, so I don't have to mean it anymore, you know, I'm with the big boys. You know, and I know how to do it. So that turns into the opposite of the path of faith. Rather than it becoming an expression of yourself, it starts becoming a betrayal of yourself. And that doesn't mean there's something wrong with the system. You're just not using it right. Right? It's like, for instance, you know, you sometimes hear couples speak in endearing ways. You know? So, how are you, honey? Sweetie, could you pass the sugar? Of course, honey bunch. Oh, honeysuckle. But have you ever heard two people using endearing terminology in very hateful ways? Right? Where you hear, say, sweetheart, could you pass the sugar? Sure, honey bunch. And you realize that there's nothing wrong with speaking in an endearing way. But when the speaking the endearing way becomes divorced from it becoming expression of your relationship, and it turns into a cover-up, and you think because you talk the talk, you're walking the walk, then you're in big trouble. That doesn't mean, well, then stop speaking in an endearing way. It means start meaning what you're speaking. Right? But what happens is, I've seen people kind of jump into Judaism, and then they start, you know, taking on the mitzvot, and losing themselves, and then blaming the mitzvahs for losing themselves, when it wasn't the mitzvahs, it wasn't the lifestyle, it was really not being real with your process, or deeply understanding what you're doing, why you're doing it, you know. And then it becomes an expression of self, rather than a betrayal of self.
This presentation by Rabbi David Aaron has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation. and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.